The 1995 Sunstone Symposium presents session number 110, Book of Mormon Witnesses and the Nature of Religious Testimony by Dan Vogel, and with comments by Scott Follering.
Well, I guess since the it's about a quarter to nine, we should start. I'd like to welcome everybody to this session of the Sunstone Symposium entitled Book of Mormon Witnesses and the Nature of Religious Testimony with Dan Vogel. I'm Jay Bell. I'll be introducing Dan. Contrary to the program, there will not be a respondent. Unfortunately, Scott Follering was unable to make it today. Dan Vogel is a graduate of California State University at Long Beach in history. He has had quite a long career in speaking at Sunstone Symposiums. In fact, I'm beginning to wonder if they would exist without him, at least doing one speech. He is a scholar on the early life of Joseph Smith. He has published extensively in Sunstone and in Dialogue and other journals on various aspects of Joseph Smith's life, which all the way with his dealings with the Book of Mormon to such other topics as treasure hunting and other material of that nature. He has also done extensive publishing and talking and research on Book of Mormon translation, other aspects of the Book of Mormon, and also even got into such various topics as the gift of tongues, or what's commonly referred to as glossolalia. So he's very well-rounded in the early aspects of church history. I might add, too, that Dan has come out with three books that I personally have enjoyed a great deal. The first two I can remember as an undergraduate going around going, somebody needs to do this, but boy, the research would kill you. And so what did Dan do? He published it, The Indian Origins of the Book of Mormon, and also The Religious Seekers, two very good works. He is also was the editor with The Word of God, essays on Mormon scholarship, and also he is coming out with a three-volume book that I'm looking forward to is Early Mormon Documents, which is going to be basically a compilation of various important documents that has to do with early church history. But anyway, without further ado, I'll turn it over to Dan, and then afterwards we'll have question and answer.
Thank you, Jay. Thanks for everybody showing up. I'm glad to see everybody here. And I guess before I start, I would probably mention that I would maybe slightly change the title to Book of Mormon Witnesses and the Limitations of Religious Testimony. That might capture what I'm trying to do a little better. And it's more about freedom to choose what you want to believe. So I guess I'll dive in to my talk here. Apologists have long put forth the idea that the three and eight witnesses provide two kinds of testimony, one spiritual, the other physical, that the two testimonies are complementary, the spiritual proving that Joseph Smith did not simply make some plates, and the physical, proving that he did not delude the three witnesses. This argument, like most apologetic devices, is designed to persuade, not to enlighten. Regardless, the true historical situation surrounding the experiences of the three and eight witnesses is more ambiguous than implied by apologists. In this essay, I will examine the published testimonies of the three and eight witnesses and other related historical sources. My purpose is to critically assess the nature of the experiences of the two groups. I will not explore the question of the witness's honesty and trustworthiness. This has been exploited at great length by apologists, whose usual intent is to present non-believers with a false dichotomy, which deposits either the witnesses told the truth about their experiences, and therefore Joseph Smith's claims about the plates are true, or the witnesses lied and the plates never existed. This either-or reduction oversimplifies the rather complex situation facing historians who wish to examine the experiences of the Book of Mormon witnesses. The important question is not whether the witnesses were trustworthy, respectable citizens of their communities, or whether they were sober or otherwise intelligent individuals, or whether they continued to maintain their belief in the Book of Mormon throughout their lives. The real question, the question explored in this essay, centers on the nature of their experiences and whether their experiences deserve greater respect from us than other similar religious testimony. In other words, are the testimonies of the Book of Mormon witnesses different than the many examples of religious testimony confronting historians? Because the testimony of three witnesses relies on a solely visionary experience, apologists place great deal of weight on the testimony of eight witnesses, which they assume was a result of a purely natural and physical encounter with the plates. Excuse me. Without any reliable source describing the historical event behind the testimony of the eight witnesses, some apologists and historians have relied solely on the published testimony for their reconstructions. However, I argue that the published testimonies by themselves are historically unreliable and therefore cannot be safely used in recreating the historical situation for either group. In fact, the testimonies as historical documents are disappointing. They fail to give historical details such as time, place, and date, nor do they adequately describe the historical events behind them. The testimony of the three witnesses, for example, simply states that the three signatories, collectively, were shown the plates by an angel. Yet, through subsequent statements, primarily made by Joseph Smith, Martin Harris, and David Whitmer, we learn that the three witnesses did not experience the vision together, that Harris's vision occurred separately. Both Harris and Whitmer later testified that they had seen in the vision a table upon which were the breastplate, Urim and Thummim, Liahona, Sword of Laban, and brass plates, a detail missing from the testimony. The testimony also fails to mention the angel speaking, although it does mention the voice of God. The subsequent statements of Whitmer and Harris also indicate that their experiences were more inward and subjective than implied by the naturalistic language of the testimony, which fails to mention the angel's glory. Clearly, without subsequent statements of Whitmer and Harris, our understanding of the experiences of the three witnesses would have been extremely limited and faulty. Our brief examination of the testimony of three witnesses should stand as a caution against trying to reconstruct the experience of the eight witnesses based solely on information derived from the published testimony. Yet this is exactly what some apologists and historians have done. Without subsequent statements by the participants, we would not have known that the testimony of three witnesses was really a composite document of more than one event, or that those events were more visionary than implied by the published testimony. Similarly, comparable assumptions and errors are probably being made when attempting to reconstruct the historical event behind the testimony of eight witnesses on the published testimony alone. Ultimately, I hope to show that the testimony of eight witnesses cannot be accepted at face value, and that their experience with the plates was probably less physical than commonly assumed. Unfortunately, the eight witnesses left very few statements on record, due mostly to their early deaths. Nevertheless, there is evidence suggesting that their experience was at least partly visionary. Indeed, the apparent materialism of the testimony might simply reflect our own assumptions about the physical limitations of visionary or hallucinatory experiences. Before tackling the problems associated with the testimony of eight witnesses, there is much to be gleaned from a closer examination of the testimony of three witnesses. We want to learn all we can about the nature of the experiences of the three witnesses, especially since, I will argue, the experience of the eight witnesses, minus the angel and the voice of God, may not have been dissimilar. Despite the use of naturalistic language in the testimony of three witnesses, particularly its emphasis on the witnesses seeing the plates with their eyes, as well as its failure to mention the angel's glory, subsequent statements by Harris and Whitmer brought out the visionary or hallucinatory aspects of their experiences. Harris, for example, told several residents of Palmyra that he had seen the plates with his spiritual eyes. And the subjective aspects of Whitmer's experience were brought out in an 1885 interview conducted by James Henry Moyle, who noted in his diary, "Mr. D. Whitmer Sr. did not handle the plates, only saw them. Says he did see them and the angel and heard him speak, but that it was indescribable, that it was through the power of God. He then spoke of Paul hearing and seeing Christ, but his associates did not, because it is only seen in the Spirit." Moyle then asked a question that attempted to further ascertain the angel's appearance, if the angel's appearance was an objective or inward experience. "I asked if the atmosphere about them was normal. In other words, did the angel appear in normal surroundings, or did the vision entirely obscure the natural world?" According to Whitmer, "It was indescribable, but the light was bright and clear, yet apparently of a different kind of light, something of a soft haze." Moyle, a Mormon and recent law school graduate, noted his disappointment in his diary. "I was not fully satisfied with the explanation. It was more spiritual than I anticipated." In their 1975 book, Apparitions, Celia Green and Charles McGreary of the Institute of Psychophysical Research, Oxford, England, state that sometimes an apparition is superimposed on the normal environment, but at other times the hallucinator loses awareness of the normal environment and the field of perception is temporarily replaced by an hallucinatory one. The latter type of experience is sometimes called a waking dream. Often what appears to the viewer as the normal environment is actually part of the hallucination. In cases in which the illumination differs from the normal, becoming either lighter or darker during the experience, Green and McCreary argue that there seems to be a strong case for regarding the entire environment as hallucinatory. Elaborating further on this point, Green and McCreary state, "Now, if the subject's surroundings appear illuminated, as well as the figure of the apparition itself, we seem driven to the conclusion that the whole environment the subject is seeing is hallucinatory. By this standard, we must conclude that Whitmer's experience was a waking dream and that his entire field of perception was hallucinatory. Unfortunately, those who interviewed Harris did not ask the kinds of questions that would yield information that would allow us to make the same qualitative assessment of his experience." Whatever the true nature of the experiences of the three witnesses, whether real or imagined, clearly one cannot refer to the natural, supernatural appearance of the angel with the plates, as one apologist has recently done. Whether Whitmer somehow knew, as Moyle reported, that his experience was comparable to the Apostle Paul's hearing and seeing Christ, but his associates did not. Whether physical or spiritual, the experiences of the witnesses were inward and subjective, and therefore limited as far as human testimony is concerned. Psychologists Peter D. Slade and Richard P. Bental define hallucination as follows: any percept-like experience which A. occurs in the absence of an appropriate stimulus, B. has the full force or impact of the corresponding actual or real perception, and C. is not amenable to direct voluntary control by the experiencer. In this sense, the experiences of the three witnesses were hallucinations, In making this assessment, I do not automatically judge the experience of the three witnesses as fiction. I merely place them in juxtaposition with other experiences that share common elements. Could Joseph Smith have hypnotized the witnesses or in some way induced a trance, as I. Woodbridge Riley and Fawn Brody suggested years ago? Even Whitmer's grandson, George W. Swyche, suggested, if that vision was not real, it was hypnotism. This possibility has never been adequately refuted by apologists. Possible evidence that Joseph Smith was familiar with hypnotism, or at least the ability of one person to cause another to hallucinate, comes from the Book of Mormon itself. Following the appearance of an angel who prevented Laman and Lemuel's continued beating of Nephi, Laman declared that Nephi worketh many things by his cunning arts, that he may deceive our eyes. The essential role of Joseph Smith played in the experience of the three witnesses is undeniable. It was by his permission that they sought to become the three promised witnesses. They followed him into the woods. They obeyed his instructions regarding the order of prayer. And they had the vision because he was with them. Even Harris had no vision experience until Joseph had joined him. We might well ask, why was Joseph Smith's presence required at an event not requiring his presence? Hallucinations can occur in otherwise normal individuals, that is, persons free from psychiatric impairment. At any given time, a segment of the population, anywhere from 1 to 8%, can be made to hallucinate, either through hypnotic suggestion or non-hypnotic suggestion, sometimes called task motivational instruction. In other words, hypnotism is not essential for the production of hallucination. Simple suggestion is sufficient. Moreover, Smith's unique claims would have attracted the kinds of persons susceptible to visionary experiences. Thus, the percentage of hallucinators among Smith's early followers was probably much higher than a random sampling of the general population. Significantly, each of the three witnesses had a visionary history before they gathered to pray in the wilderness near the Whitmer farm in late June 1829. Such testimony must be considered if we are to fully understand the men who signed the testimony of three witnesses. It is certainly far more revealing than Oliver Cowdery's being a schoolteacher and later a lawyer, or Harris's being a respected businessman, or Whitmer's being a good citizen of Richmond, Missouri. Thus, Smith may have taken three highly suggestible, extremely willing subjects into the woods and used prayer as a method of induction. As Riley noted almost a century ago, repetition, steady attention, absence of mistrust, self-surrender to the will of the principal, all the requisites are present, not as formulae, but as facts. While there is much to be said about the testimony of three witnesses, I will now pursue my direct examination of the testimony of eight witnesses. Excuse me for a second. In the case of the three witnesses, we saw how important the statements of Whitmer and Harris were to understanding their experiences. The same is true for the eight witnesses, although their statements are few. Christian Whitmer, Peter Whitmer Jr., Jacob Whitmer, and Joseph Smith Sr. left no known statements regarding their Book of Mormon testimonies. Both Hiram Smith and Samuel Smith left brief statements concerning their seeing and handling the plates. Hiram Page testified only about seeing the plates. Of the eight witnesses, John Whitmer lived longest and left most on record, repeatedly testifying that he had both seen and handled the plates. Despite the rarity of additional testimony, the best interpretation will fully exploit it. The public and many church members were made aware of the true nature of the experience of the eight witnesses during an internal conflict the church experienced in Ohio and Missouri following the failure of the church-sponsored Kirtland Safety Society anti-banking company in 1837. To the delight of anti-Mormons, dissenters in Kirtland, Ohio, debated whether in their rejection of Joseph Smith's prophetic leadership, they should also exclude the Book of Mormon. The activities of the dissenters were the subject of a letter dated 15th of April, 1838, written by Stephen Burnett to Lyman E. Johnson, a former member of the Quorum of 12 Apostles living in far west Missouri, who was also troubled by the Kirtland Bank scandal. According to Burnett, the Kirtland dissenters differed among themselves about the status of the Book of Mormon. Warren Parrish, Luke S. Johnson, and John Boynton argued that the Book of Mormon should be rejected, while Martin Harris, Cyrus Smalling, and Joseph Coe continued to believe in the book despite their rejection of Joseph Smith. Burnett said that Martin Harris declared at a public meeting that he never saw the plates with his natural eyes, and that the eight witnesses also never saw them with their natural eyes, and hesitated to sign that instrument for that reason, but were persuaded to do it. If the witnesses whose names are attached to the Book of Mormon never saw the plates as Martin Harris admits, Burnett concluded, then there can be nothing brought to prove that any such thing ever existed. Burnett's account is supported by Warren Parrish, a fellow Kirtland dissenter, who reported in August 1838 that Martin Harris, one of the subscribing witnesses, has come out at last and says he never saw the plates from which the Book of Mormon purports to have been translated, except in vision, and he further says that any man who says he has seen them in any other way is a liar, Joseph Smith not excepted. Parrish then supplies the scriptural reference alluded to by Harris, the revelation dictated by Joseph Smith in June 1829 that promised full witnesses a view of the plates on condition of faith. It is by your faith that you shall obtain a view of them, and instructed them to testify to the world that they have seen the plates, even as my servant Joseph Smith, Jr. has seen them. For it is by my power that he has seen them, and it is because he had faith. Harris's use of the June 1829 revelation creates serious problems for those who wish to maintain the experience of the eight witnesses was purely physical. Indeed, considering the inclusive tone of the revelation, it seems unlikely that the eight witnesses would have been exempted from the conditions required by the revelation, although the need for further witnesses had not been contemplated at the time of its reception. To maintain a purely physical experience for the eight witnesses is to believe that Joseph Smith violated the logic of this revelation only days after its reception. Although Harris had rejected Joseph Smith's leadership, he continued to believe the Book of Mormon and had little desire to impart any information that could damage the book. At a subsequent meeting, according to Burnett, Harris expressed regret about his revealing the true nature of the experience of the eight witnesses, stating that he never should have told that the testimony of the eight witnesses was false, if it had not been picked out of him, but should have let it pass as it was. The fact that Harris's disclosure, actually hurt his own position on the Book of Mormon argues strongly in favor of its truth, at least in Harris's mind. Harris's account is secondhand to be sure, but it cannot be dismissed out of hand for that reason alone. Harris was on intimate terms with the eight witnesses and therefore was in a position to know the details of their experience. Six of the eight witnesses were still alive at the time Harris made his statement, apparently without fear of contradiction. Hiram Smith's apparent response to the Kirtland dissenters, as reported by Sally Parker in August 1838, is an indirect confirmation that the dissenters were spiritualizing the experience of the eight witnesses. Parker wrote to comfort her relatives in Maine, who were evidently troubled about the developments in Kirtland. She offered two evidences that the plates were real. First, during a recent visit to her mid-Ohio town of Sunbury, Ohio, she heard Hiram Smith declare that he had but two hands and two eyes, and that he had seen the plates with his eyes and handled them with his hands. Next, she had lived near Lucy Smith and heard her describe hiding the plates under the hearth and claim to have hefted and handled the plates while covered. Both stories are obviously designed to counter the spiritualizing claims of the dissenters. Hiram's remark that he had but two eyes seems especially designed to counter dissenter claims that the eight witnesses saw the plates with their spiritual eyes. Hiram's statement is not unlike the response of David Whitmer, who in 1886 told Nathan Tanner, "I have been asked if we saw those things with our natural eyes. Of course they were our natural eyes. There is no doubt that our eyes were prepared for the sight, but they were our natural eyes nevertheless." Thus Hiram was not necessarily denying dissenter claims that he and other witnesses had seen the plates in vision or with spiritual eyes, only denouncing the implication that a vision was inferior to a purely physical experience. Is Hiram's remark that he had but two hands similarly designed to counter dissenter claims that he had also handled the plates in vision? Or is Hiram's statement that he had seen the plates with his eyes and handled them with his hands to be understood as separate events? We know that he handled the covered plates with other Smith family members at the time Joseph first brought them home. Or perhaps the plates were present at the experience of the eight witnesses, concealed in a box or other covering, and they saw the plates in vision, but only handled them while covered. Regardless, perhaps Hiram, like Whitmer and Harris, sometimes expressed separate experiences with the plates in a single sentence. It is possible, therefore, that Hiram saw the plates in vision, but like his mother, handled them while covered. Parker's account of Hiram's testimony is unusual for its mention of his also seeing the breastplate, which Hiram described as concave in shape and made of gold. If Hiram saw the plates, a breastplate, as part of his experience as one of the eight witnesses, it might be an indication that the experiences of the eight men varied, or that the testimony of eight witnesses, like that of the three witnesses, is more fragmentary than commonly assumed. Similar events in Missouri presented another of the eight witnesses with an opportunity to clarify his testimony. On the 5th of April, 1839, Theodore Turley, who was then the church's business agent in Far West, publicly questioned John Whitmer concerning his Book of Mormon testimony. Whitmer had joined with the dissenters in Missouri, and unlike Harris, had not only rejected Joseph Smith, but also the Book of Mormon. Turley wanted to know how Whitmer's testimony about the plates could be true, and yet the Book of Mormon be false. Before his anti-Mormon friends, Whitmer reaffirmed his testimony of the Book of Mormon, that he had both seen and handled the plates, but concluded by stating that the plates had been shown to me by a supernatural power. Given this experience with the plates, even if supernatural, Turley wondered how Whitmer could reject the Book of Mormon. Whitmer's responded that he could not read the original and therefore had no guarantee that Joseph Smith had translated it correctly. Assuming the experience of the eight witnesses was visionary or hallucinatory as outlined above, I offer two possible scenarios. First, the eight witnesses saw and handled the plates in vision. This is the most direct solution to the problem. However, since apparitions generally resist being touched, this is perhaps the least favored solution. But because such instances are not unknown, this possibility cannot be ruled out. Second, the plates were present in a box or cloth covering, and the eight witnesses saw through the box or cloth. Thus, each man could claim that he had both seen and handled the plates. This possibility is very much like what Harris suggested was his experience with the plates prior to his vision with Smith. Harris told John A. Clark in 1828 that he saw the plates with the eye of faith, just as distinctly as I see anything around me, though at the time they were covered with a cloth. He also told Stephen Burnett and others in 1838 that he had hefted the plates repeatedly in a box or with only a tablecloth or handkerchief over them, but he never saw them, only as he saw a city through a mountain. Harris's claim of seeing the plates through a cloth should be understood, I believe, within the context of similar claims made by seers and clairvoyants in his day. Persons known as somnambulists also claimed the ability of seeing concealed objects. In conclusion, Given the possibility that the three witnesses hallucinated and that the experience of the eight witnesses was also visionary, we have no compelling evidence that Joseph Smith really possessed anciently constructed plates. It is therefore entirely possible for Joseph Smith to have made a set of plates of common tin, which is consistent with the reported weight of between 40 and 60 pounds, which he then allowed some persons to feel through a cloth, but no one to see. Despite the efforts of apologists, the real question has never been the trustworthiness of the witnesses, but whether testimony resulting from visionary or hallucinatory situations is reliable. Indeed, does the testimony of the witnesses merit greater respect than other similar religious testimony? Or rather, was the nature of the experiences of the witnesses different from the multitude of religious testimony confronting historians? Indeed, by what criteria are we to accept the testimony of the Book of Mormon witnesses while rejecting the non-Mormon testimony? In the final analysis, I submit, there is nothing to distinguish with any degree of certainty between the presumably true hallucinations of the Book of Mormon witnesses and the theoretically false hallucinations of others. If one insists on inner subjective criteria, then were not the human testimony all the time unnecessary? Instead of producing compelling evidence in favor of the Book of Mormon, I would argue that the Book of Mormon testimonies create just another faith situation, plunging us back into the myriad of religious voices competing to be heard. Of course, each of us, using various criteria, some universal, others idiosyncratic, must ultimately decide the significance of these religious testimonies. Thank you for your indulgence.
I'd like to thank Dan for that very interesting paper. I think I've just spent some money on a tape now. I'd like to open it up for question and answer. What I'm going to do for the remainder of the time is just turn it over to Dan to call on who he'd like to. And I'm going to take the lead on this, if he doesn't mind. Dan, what I was wondering is Mother Whitmer's account of going out into a barn and praying and seeing the angel and being able to see the place, does this also coincide with the other witnesses and their accounts? Does this fit into what you've worked with? I'll start out with that question.
Yeah. For the three witnesses, it's best to view it as an event in a chain of events. We tend to look at the experiences happening just to these people just this once, but there were precipitating experiences that influenced the form in which the three witnesses experienced their vision. Oliver Cowdery, before he even met Joseph Smith, had a vision of Jesus showing him the plates. This is according to Joseph Smith's 1832 account. And then we have Harris, of course. I mentioned seeing the plates through the cloth before seeing the plates with the angel. David Whitmer is more interesting, I think, because he has experience, his family and himself have the experience of seeing three unusual men working in his field before he goes to pick up Smith and Cowdery in Harmony, Pennsylvania in May, June, 1829. When Whitmer picks Cowdery and Harris up and they're on their return trip to Fayette, Whitmer sees the messenger with what he surmised as the plates in a sack on his shoulder going to the Hill Cumorah, he said. Then when Whitmer actually arrives at Fayette, he believes he sees the messenger with the plates near the shed, the Whitmer shed. And he asks Smith, this is according to Edward Stevenson's interview, he asks Smith if the plates are there under the shed, and Smith says the plates are present on the farm under the shed. So the next day, Mary Musselman Whitmer goes out to milk the cows, and she sees the angel show her the plates. And this is before the experience of the three witnesses, about a month before. And so I think this probably has an influence on what the expectations of what the three witnesses will experience in the woods when they go to, at the end of that month. Not sure who exactly, but Joseph Smith said, implied in the history of the church that it wasn't him, that they wrote it up. But the testimonies have a unifying effect of multiple experience. So we don't know how. There are some hints that it's not complete picture. It's a general unifying statement that the three at least could agree on to sign together. I'll go over this way this time.
Is there any kind of...
You mean residents of these different areas?
Residents, church members, anti-Mormons, produce the plates and want to see them.
To see them uncovered? As I argued, no one saw them uncovered, really, in a natural, physical way. No one would be asking that question, really. Except there are residents of Palmyra and Harmony that claimed later, not friendly sources, but they claimed later that Joseph had promised after the plates were translated that he would show them to them, and that they were upset that he never did. But there were other church members, of course, that saw visions of the plates and the angel in the plates besides the eight witnesses. In that kind of environment, as you can tell later, Joseph had a problem holding people's religious enthusiasm in check. So it wasn't going to be a hard thing to find witnesses in that kind of environment. To settle what?
To settle the clamor. See the plates. It was a ruse to solve that problem. I guess the question is, did it work or didn't it work? Or did it continue to be a problem through the 1838 to 31, 1832? Where did you find a total absence of people wanting to see the plates, saying, you don't have any record of that?
Well, Joseph, as you know, didn't have the plates around, really, when he was translating. The plates weren't even usually present, and he just read the translation from the stone. So they weren't really there around where he could just like show them. And then Lucy Harris, Martin Harris's wife, wanted to see them, but Joseph hid them in the woods so that wouldn't pester him for seeing them. But delivered the plates up, so he didn't possess them anymore. And even with the experience of the eight witnesses, according to Lucy, the angel had to bring the plates to the woods in order for them to be viewed. So Joseph didn't have them to show. It was in God's control to show them to whoever he wanted at a very... very soon, even while he was doing it. The experience of the eight witnesses has happened right as the book is being finished translating. You know, so there is really no chance. He had a good reason not to be able to show anybody.
Well, of course, if it was a hallucinatory experience or hypnosis or something of that nature, Joseph Smith conjured that up in 1831 or 1832 or 1833.
You mean at the request of people?
At the request of people.
Okay, well, there's none of those kinds of situations that I know of. Back there.
I understand that Martin Harris
Clarkston, Utah, and made some comments on his deathbed, reaffirming his testimony. Do you have that statement that he made, and what was the nature of it exactly?
Yeah, he did make statements on his deathbed, that's true. Most of the testimonies we have about the deathbed statements date to the early 1900s, and they're more reminiscences. But someone tried to claim that different story. But Harris didn't leave as detailed descriptions as David Whitmer, and especially the instance with James Henry Moyle, who's a law student and probably well practiced in interviewing people or cross-examining. He came with a specific question of trying to establish the materiality of the experience of the three witnesses, pardon me, and came away disappointed. So he had an objective to his questioning, and so he's really certain about it being a total inward experience with David Whitmer.
But what did Martin Harris say?
His isn't as detailed. The interviews are only as good as the interviewer, if you know what I mean. If the interviewer isn't savvy about psychological principles or things of that nature, they're not going to ask the right questions. Most of the interviewers of Martin Harris and David Whitmer really they were after affirmations. All they wanted was to explain, in David Whitmer's case, to explain why he wasn't a member of the church and if he still believed the Book of Mormon, and that was what they were after mostly. With Martin Harris, the records we have of Martin Harris's testimony aren't as detailed and as numerous as David Whitmer's. Over here.
There's two areas that, as I listen to you talk, that kind of bother me. One, talking about developing the theory of spiritual or hallucinatory experiences. And you cite the cases of more modern research and so forth that has gone on. And you've evolved it to going back to make these things appear spiritual or hallucinatory. Then the other part is going back to just what you had just alluded to concerning asking the right questions. Because you then cited cases afterwards of people interviewing the witnesses and their statements, and thus concluding that it wasn't to be a spiritual experience or hallucinatory. If, for instance, Martin Harris' thing was just asking the wrong questions, what's to say those situations that you cited earlier in early history were not asking the wrong questions or taken out of context?
You mean,
in other words, you're drawing different things to come to different theories to draw a conclusion. And yet, I find it a rather large leap to draw those conclusions.
Exactly.
The things that you stated.
Are you saying that it was not an inward experience that the three witnesses experienced? A physical, spiritual
thing. When we talk about spiritual eyes.
Okay, so that everyone can follow this. When the three witnesses had their visionary experience, if someone else walked into the woods while they're having it, would they have seen the angel and the plates?
It's a spiritual experience, but they did not say it was a spiritual experience. They stated it in their statement.
Oh, in their testimony.
In their testimony.
It sounds natural.
Now, you're drawing a conclusion from various other sources that it was indeed a spiritual experience.
Yeah, I'm saying
there's a leap here.
Well, there's also like a leap when the testimony doesn't mention the seeing the other objects either. But in subsequent testimony, They described the experience was more full and more detailed than the testimony would allow us to extrapolate. So, in the sense of the spiritual versus physical, if you walked into the woods while the witnesses were viewing the angel and the plates, if it was a totally inward experience, if we weren't spiritually enlightened, we wouldn't see anything, right? But if it was a naturalistic spiritual experience, in the sense that the angel actually came down and the plates were actually there in the woods that day, we would see it if we happened to walk by. Okay, so I would just have to defer to the more detailed cross-examining that, like Moyle and others gave on certain matters. They were trying to ascertain that very question, and Moyle was a law student and a Mormon, believing Mormon, and he was disappointed with the answer. He pressed Whitmer and he wanted it to be otherwise. So I would argue that just like any statement that anyone gives, when you're cross-examined by someone else, more details will come out of that cross-examination. Plus, I would also argue that Whitmer might not have been the author of the testimony, and if he wrote it, he might have written it different. You know, so it was just a testimony that's a general statement, like most affidavit type things are. Something that all three men could sign to say that they saw the angel in the plates. And it does imply a naturalistic thing indirectly, because it doesn't mention the angel's glory, and it leads many people to read it in many different ways. And that's why it's the subsequent testimony is very, very important to understanding that document.
At the same time, if we all walk out of this room and we're interviewed individually about how we view on the stand and what we saw specifically, there would be many different accounts and various recollections. It would be the same perception that each individual can carry those things into an experience. And certainly we will all relate differently to that experience. So I have no problem with various accounts being different.
Well, that's okay. Like I said, everyone's free to choose. It's not an open and shut case. That what I'm arguing is that the testimony of the eight witnesses apparently being a physical experience that we've all, and the paintings that you've seen, those paintings are not historically reliable. They're just an artist's conception of a superficial reading of the testimonies. But that image might not be true. And so some people might choose to believe the testimony and others might not, based on their own feelings about the value of religious testimony in general. What I'm saying is we're not trapped. It's not like, the Catholics have the Shroud of Turin, you know, kind of thing, physical thing, how you can't deny the resurrection, can you? We got you trapped. So the testimony of the eight witnesses is a Mormon kind of Shroud of Turin in a way. They saw the physical plates, how do you answer that? Kind of, you know, that's kind of the thing that the testimony puts forth. But it's all been implied, never exactly outlined. Is your hand up?
Yeah. Okay. Could you discuss the historical plausibility of the man's construction?
I would argue that if this is hypothetical, not necessarily conclusive, okay? Joseph Smith had access to common tin, and his father was a cooper that used tin in making barrels. There's tin scrap heaps all over the place, and if he had the means to make them, to hammer them, to punch holes in them very easily with a nail or a punch hole. He had rods on hand that he could bend into shape This is hypothetical, okay? And they would be consistent. They would weigh the between 40 and 60 pounds. Now, if you took 6 by 8 by 6 equals 288 cubic inches, and if you calculate it at a solid block, which it wasn't, though, 10 would weigh 74 and a half pounds. If you put a 30% reduction because of space, possible spacing between the plates, it'd be about 52 pounds. Gold, on the other hand, if it were solid, theoretically, would be about 200 pounds with a 30% reduction, 140 pounds. So, even if it were some kind of mixture, it's still way too much. But anyway, he had means, and he also had, if you read Lucy's history, he had the opportunity to, there's time. He was doing something up on that hill that night, you know.
What the eternal gospel principle precludes non-believing persons from viewing the place? I mean, why couldn't there have been a witness that didn't believe and didn't have a connection to Joseph Smith, yet saw them and wrote it down as an affidavit? Why couldn't he take it to the county assessor or whatever? What eternal principle stopped him from that?
Eternal principle had to have him conceal the plates? You know, did Moses come down with the Ten Commandments and say, look, here, fill under the cloth, you know? The only reason I can think of that you couldn't see the plates is that Joseph made a set of plates that could pass a feeling test, hefting and feeling the rings, like William Smith said, but they could not be seen. He could not do that. Someone that hasn't.
Could you comment on something that's puzzled me? We're told that after Joseph lost 160 pages, the Urim and Thummim was taken away. Why, if God wanted him to translate the plagues, would he take away the very thing that would make it easier for him to do it?
Beats me. I mean, but he ends up using the stone that he used in his treasure digging, in the stone in the hat, and dictating the translation that way. In full view, for the most part, I guess. Is there a follow up?
Yeah, I can ask a follow up. As you read David Whitmer's accounts and the accounts of the Whitmer farm, there's one I read where somebody refuted the idea that there was a blanket between the scribe and Joseph Smith that said the blanket was actually across the room so that when somebody would open the door, it would keep it private. Have you heard that from any other source?
David Whitmer's the one that made the big deal out of the curtain not being, because it was a common understanding. Okay. Martin Harris told Professor Anthon that there was a curtain between them. Martin Harris also told John A. Clark, of the minister in Palmyra, that there was a curtain. This was all during the time before actually working on the translation. This was during the time where Joseph supposedly copied the characters, you know, and things like that, before even Martin Harris started to become scribe for Smith. But later, as Harris became scribe for Smith, he does give accounts that Joseph was putting the stone in the hat. And this is even before, of course, losing the 116 pages. But David Whitmer, when you read his address to all believers in Christ, you have to be very careful, because he's not just relating history. He's using his experiences as argumentation. What he's trying to do is to say Joseph Smith could not have used a Spalding manuscript because he was in full view of the scribe and anyone who wanted to come into the room of the Whitmer family at that time. So he isn't describing every, he wasn't there all the time, but he's saying that generally the curtain was not separating the scribe and Joseph Smith and his dictating from the head thing.
This idea of a physical plates, whether tin or gold from Moroni, whatever, is interesting. Is it your opinion that there had to have been a physical object for the testimonies of people feeling it through the through a cloth or maybe carrying it for Joseph? Or is it possible that those could be categorized as a hallucinatory spritz also? I guess I'm wondering, is there an absolute case where it had to be a physical object that resembled plates?
Yeah. Well, in my opinion, there is. When he first brings them home, and he hands them through the window to Josiah Stoll that was there. He handled them in that cloth, that frock he had bound around the plates. And William Smith, the Smith family generally, it was a physical object, and they put it into a trunk, you know, a box. So it's a very physical, that's not hallucination, that's not a hallucinatory environment, if you know what I mean. There was no praying, you know, praying and bring him out. But I think in the experience of the eight witnesses, it could go either way. It could be totally that they handled it in a hallucinatory way, actually filled them in a visionary way, or like John Whitmer said, a visionary experience. And then, or it could have been there in a cloth, so they did handle it. So you're just trying to do the best you can with all the sources that are available to find a theory that harmonizes all the information that we have.
Wasn't there a conjecture? Well, I know that we weren't here yet. At the time, there were a lot of artifacts being found. That's what got the Smith family into the digging to begin with. But isn't there some conjecture that similar plates could have been found and Joseph Smith got his hands on them? Not necessarily gold plates, but artifact-type plates. Is there any? Is that just conjecture, rumor, or is there any potentiation to that theory?
Well, there were Indian artifacts found in the mounds. Not that the Hill Cumorah is an Indian mound, but there were hammered copper plates with designs on them found in Ohio and in other places, which encouraged the money diggers that maybe they'll find something of value. See, that the Indians in that area, you know, the woodland Indians, could make an artifact like the gold plates is kind of totally out of that realm. Okay. Let me finish this one. But the story that Joseph Smith gave was not unbelievable because his money-digging friends were like in a frenzy to get the plates from him. They believed the story. They believed he got the plates and he was holding them back. So at the very least, Joseph Smith was telling a story that many people in his environment would find believable, including his father, who was a money digger. Okay, one more. Okay, that was the fastest. Well, of course they weren't. The Seer Stone was there, but the plates, Joseph Smith said he gave up the plates in his 1838 history and that they're still in his presence today. So there's no, I wouldn't believe what people were gossiping about in the 1880s without, you know, some sort of further evidence. Sure.
When John Whitmer was saying that his experience was more than natural, is that a first-hand account or a second-hand account?
No, it's reported by Theodore Turley, the guy that was asking the question, in a document probably dated to the early 1840s, in a memorandum. And it also was got published in the History of the Church. So he says it was shown to him, the plates were shown to him by the power of God, which is consistent with the 1829 revelation promising the three witnesses that that would be the case, and that Joseph Smith hadn't even seen them in any other way. Anyway, thank you, everybody.
Apologies, I thought you answered that question. I didn't realize I was going to say something to the middle of your answer.
That's it.
I was wondering, Dan, you look at Moody's work on, you know,